He jerked to a halt, gesturing sharply for his companions to do the same. He flexed his wrist tendons, and with a faint whir of its tiny electric motor, the forearm holster slapped his Sin-Eater into his hand. Grant's own hand blaster jumped into his palm, and he looked around, eyes narrowed.
What is it?
Then the Valkyries seemed to rise up out of the ground. Kane caught only disorganized, fragmented glimpses of gigantic horned figures bounding all around, shrieking like demons just loosed from hell. The figures were all female and of huge stature, several a good half-head taller than Kane. Their bare legs were like marble columns, their long hair like gold, which matched the massive armlets binding their wrists and biceps. Glittering tunics of silver scale mail and the high-horned helmets added to their supernatural aspect. The bright, clear light glittered from the razored edges of axes, swords, and spear points. Grant and Kane reacted as quickly as their bulky garments allowed, instinctively shifting to back-to-back positions, their index fingers touching the trigger studs of their Sin-Eaters. Phil Boyd uttered a squalling cry of shock and struggled to bring up his copperhead. The wooden shaft of a spear struck the side of his head with an ugly thud. The man toppled to the ground, slamming against the legs of Kane and Grant, knocking them off balance. Bridget Baptiste leaped in front of the two men, putting herself between the gun barrels and the Valkyries.
Gefrieren! Gefrieren!
The Valkyries suddenly lurched to a halt. The bladed weapons weren't withdrawn, but they were lowered. Still, Bridget, Kane, and Grant stood within a circle of menacing steel.
I guess my pronunciation of ancient Germanic isn't as bad as I thought. I told them to stop.
Kane's stomach muscles fluttered with adrenaline and tension.
I think the fact that you can speak their language at all, combined with your coloring, had more to do with it than your pronunciation.
Now that the women were no longer circling them, Kane realized they were less demonic than splendid savages, clean-limbed and shapely despite their stature. Their skin was snowy white, their eyes varying in color from deep gray to bright blue. The loose, unbound hair that flowed down from the edges of metal helmets was blonde or red or a shade in between, much like Brigid's sunset-colored mane. There were only five of the warrior women, not the howling horde of Kane's first impression. But still, their eyes blazed with ferocity and suspicion. The tallest of the women, whose helmet sported a pair of polished, curving bull's horns, addressed Brigid with a string of harsh consonants, her tone provocative and angry.
Ich heiße Gundrun. Tochter von Ranir, Sohn von Thorfinn. Ich bin Häuptling von den Valkyren von
Bridget listened intently, frowning a little in concentration.
Her name is Gundrun, daughter of Thorfinn's son Ranir. She is chieftain of the Valkyries of Ultima Thule, the choosers of the slain.
Judging by her attitude, she's more like the choosers of who will be slain.
Warum macht diese zwei von ihren Männern bedecken ihre Gesichter?
She wants to know why two of my men have their faces covered. She asks if you are hiding something or are you ashamed of something?
Grant snorted and tugged down his balaclava, revealing his face. At his feet, Phil Boyd hiked himself up on an elbow and did the same. He started to put his eyeglasses back on, but a spear point darted toward him, lightly pressing against the side of his neck. Gundrun's appraising gaze flicked over all of them.
Die Welt außerhalb hat großartig geändert. Sonst der Wolf, der schwarze Bär...
The outside world has changed greatly, else the wolf, the black bear, and the weasel would not hunt with one of our own orphans.
Kane turned to Grant.
You must be the black bear, and I'm the wolf.
How do you know you're not one of the other two?
Because I obviously don't look anything like an orphaned weasel.
She didn't say orphaned weasel. She said...
Fricka nur wenn gesprochen mit Arschloch!
Gundrun shook her spear in their direction. The two men subsided, and Bridget cast them an annoyed over-the-shoulder glance.
Do I need to translate any of that?
Both men shook their heads.
Ich hätte diese zwei gehackte in Seehundsfleisch. Was wollen Sie hier?
Bitte verzeihen Sie meinen Freunden. Wir kommen Frieden herein. Wir bringen dringende Nachrichten für ihre Leute. Wir müssen mit ihrem Herrscher sprechen, bevor es zu spät ist.
Sehr gut. Folge mir.
Gundrun and her Valkyries stepped back, gesturing with their weapons.
Gundrun was ready to have you two chopped to seal meat. I convinced her that we have urgent news for her people. She agreed to take us to their ruler.
this was a movie, I'd say we should try to wow their ruler with feats of legerdemain.
Something tells me the Tullians will be a tough crowd.
Ihr müsst uns ihre Waffen geben.
She wants her weapons.
Cain eyed all the steel pointed in their direction and the implacable expression on the faces of the Tullian warriors.
I don't think that's a sound tactic. They seem awfully moody to me.
Yeah, me too.
Phil Boyd put his glasses on and, wincing, slowly got to his feet.
I agree. But if we don't do what they say, they'll try to kill us, and we'll have to kill them.
Where are the interlopers here?
Their people came out to the Sific. They're the invaders. I'm here to put a stop to their raids.
We're not that sure of our facts. That's why we need to talk to someone in authority.
Grant and Cain didn't move for a long moment. Then Phil Boyd unslung his copperhead and handed it over to a Valkyrie. The woman examined the subgun briefly and smiled at him, almost in gratitude.
They're just as nervous about us as we are about them.
I can't imagine why.
Cain leathered his sin-eater, undid the buckles and tabs of the power holster, and handed it over to Gundrun. Glowering, Grant did the same.
Take care of that. I'll be really pissed if it picks up any rust.
With two of the Valkyries behind them and the other two flanking them, Brigid, Phil Boyd, Grant, and Cain were marched through the settlement, bare rock giving way to frost-slippery pavement. As they approached the body of water, the air temperature rose appreciably, and they saw less and less ice. Cain leaned down close to Brigid.
I noticed you didn't give up your gun.
A faint smile ghosted over her lips.
As long as the Valkyries didn't notice.
Cain repressed his own smile and felt his confidence rise. Feet crunching on gravel, they followed a twisting lane that brought them out almost on the shore of the lake, near a small inlet. The cove was of some size, and it was literally crammed with the wrecks and hulks of old ships, some intact, but most of them dismantled, either by tools or the merciless hand of time. They saw the stern of a coracle and the bowsprit of a longboat. They were marched past warped deck planking, broken masts, portions of keels, frames, and even part of a wheelhouse with the glass in the portholes still within the brass frames. The cove was less a graveyard of old ships than a maritime junkyard, where seagoing vessels had been brought to be dismantled and cannibalized. There didn't seem to be an order of placement, either by ship type or era. They were all heaped together in a clutter. They tramped over old wooden belaying pins, blocks, tackle, hatches, oars, sails that had rotted to little more than scraps of canvas. Rearing up out of the clutter, they saw the carved dragon figurehead of a Viking longship. The bow was a wreck, the hull planking caved in and splintered. On the far side of the wreckage yard, a sleek, dark vessel loomed large on the rocky shore, half-submerged so it resembled a beached killer whale. Its hull was made of rust-streaked steel plates. A conning tower arose from its sleek surface amidships. It was canted over on its port side, half-crushing a much smaller vessel that reminded Cain of a small schooner. Although the paint was peeled, a serial number was still visible on the conning tower, as was a simple swastika.
An Unterseeboot.
A what?
A U-boat. A submarine. That's obviously what brought the Kriegsmarine sailors here.
She turned to Phil Boyd.
I didn't know you spoke German, Brewster.
He shrugged.
When you work in anything to do with space travel, you're bound to run into a few German scientists. I picked up a smattering here and there.
But why were there dead German sailors in the ventilation shaft?
Two possibilities. The crew of the sub either volunteered to help out around here as part of the community, or they were enslaved.
The Valkyries herded them toward a 12-foot-long boat made of planks, tethered to a boulder by a length of leather. With its upcurving bow, it resembled a gondola. With prods of the spears, Phil Boyd, Grant, Brigid, and Cain climbed aboard. Gundren and another Valkyrie climbed into it while the other two remained on the shore. One of them snatched the tether free and pushed the boat easily into the water. To the surprise of the four outlanders, they saw an outboard motor clamped to the squared-off stern of the vessel. Gundren started it with a single yank of the pull cord. She gunned the throttle, turning it toward the open water. The prow cut through it on a rush of foam.
Really an odd mixture of technology. Late Bronze Age, melded with middle 20th century.
Brigid nodded contemplatively.
They managed to adapt and borrow without changing the basic underpinnings of their culture.
Somebody taught them how to repair motors like these, perform maintenance on them.
Not to mention provide them with fuel.
The Germans, maybe.
Maybe.
The farther the boat pushed out into the lake, the warmer the air became. On impulse, Grant removed a glove and put a hand into the water. It felt like tepid bath water.
The water is warm.
Bridget nodded.
I figured as much. This lake must be fed by some sort of volcanic geothermals.
Kane experimentally plunged his hand in as well, eliciting a glare from Gundrun.
A lake warm enough not to freeze is one thing. This has to be at least 70 degrees. That can't be natural.
Bridget nodded again.
My thoughts exactly.
By the time they were able to see details in the island of rock thrusting up out of the middle of the lake, the air was so humid, sweat formed on their bodies. They opened their jackets. Then, as they went on, they shed the parkas altogether. Fortunately, the shadow suits adjusted to the new temperature and quickly made them comfortable again. As dark crags rising from the lake began towering above them, Kane felt the prickling of apprehension at the base of his spine. It wasn't an island at all, but more of a rocky spire projecting out of the water like a sheer-walled cone, at least 100 feet tall. The sides rose up to the rim, which was wreathed in fog and steam. No shoreline was visible, only a deep V-cut cleft. Within it, a great flight of stone steps climbed from the lake surface to the pinnacle. Gundrun piloted the boat expertly over the waves to the foot of the stone stairs. She steered the craft slowly between dark ramparts of rock. When the hull grated on stone, she cut the engine. She tossed a mooring line to her companion, who climbed out and looped it securely around a rock.
Asgard, bring to me your Zinus foyers.
Asgard? As in home of the Norse gods?
No. Asgard as in a volcanic peak that's heating up the Antarctic ice sheet to the melting point.
The conflict of ice and fire. Ragnarok indeed.
The climb to the top of the peak wouldn't have been so strenuous if the air hadn't seemed to become more stiflingly hot and humid with every step. Even with the shadow suit's internal thermal controls, the four outlanders perspired freely. Kane reflected that the temperature didn't feel much different than that on Thunder Isle. When they reached the pinnacle, sidling between two bastions of rune-covered rock onto a flat plateau, they were almost too tired and hot to be impressed by the sight that met their eyes. A broad avenue paved with white pebbles stretched away in front of them. White buildings chased with golden porticos shouldered each other. A row of fluted, slender towers rose at the end of the avenue, giving the illusion of being tall, but in actuality they weren't more than three stories high. They stretched up in twisting spirals, colored in fantastic hues of gold and red and blue. Above them hung the umbrella of steam, which shifted and rolled.
This doesn't even look real. It's like something out of an amusement park.
The Valkyries growled gutturally and gestured to the tallest of the towers at the end of the white-pebbled avenue. It was centered between a pair of smaller structures. The four people fell into step behind the two warriors. Water dripped down from above, not quite a drizzle or mist, but every surface gleamed with moisture. They didn't march very far. Long before Bridget, Kane, Philboyd, and Grant thought to have reached the tower, they were entering an arched doorway.
What the hell?
Kane looked around with baffled eyes and guessed the tower was situated in the exact center of the plateau.
Optical foreshortening. Everything is built up here on a forced perspective to give this place the feeling of being much larger than it is.
Kane didn't say anything, but he was impressed by how quickly the man figured it out. Escorted by the Valkyries, they were marched into an open hall, the walls of which were of marble with golden scrollwork crawling across them. A concourse of Valkyries stood stiffly along the walls, each one gripping a long spear. Tall, winged helmets were on their heads, and armlets of gold and silver, all gem-encrusted, gleamed on their bare arms. Each one carried a round shield with the Thulian swastika embossed on the surface. The honor guard paid no heed to the people as they entered the hall. On the floor, a series of gold-inlaid tiles stretched forth, and in the center of the chamber they formed a collar around a disk of a translucent substance. A blaze of yellow and orange light shimmered from below the tile-collared disk. Kane estimated it was 20 feet in diameter, if not more. On the far side of the collar, the tiles resumed their straight line. They led up to a broad, elevated platform upon which towered an elaborate, high-backed throne. Sitting on the throne was a figure that caused Kane's throat to tighten and what little moisture remained in his mouth to dry to a dusty film. A huge man sat slumped there, silent and brooding. One gauntleted hand idly fondling the jeweled hilt of a gleaming broadsword lying across his knees. His massive limbs were clothed in blue-tinged mail. His entire torso was covered in a fantastic armor that appeared, at first glance, to be wrought of pure ice that sparkled in the light dancing from the disc in the floor. A cloak of sky blue hung from his wide shoulders, fastened by a huge brooch pin. The man was very old. A snow-white beard fell halfway to his waist. Hair of the same bleached-out hue tumbled around his shoulders. His right eye was covered by a blue leather patch with a swastika design worked into it with gold thread. His left eye was deeply sunk under his grizzled brow, but it blazed as if from a fire within. An ornate helmet sat on his head, which made him seem even more of a giant. It too appeared fashioned of gold, with curving horns of a burnished alloy that arched backward over the jeweled crest of the headpiece. The man exuded a palpable aura of age, mystery, and power. His single eye was like a window into a forgotten past, which was full of only dark memories and glories long past. Although it was hard to tell in the wavering light, the man appeared to be at least 6 feet tall, sitting down.
Knien Sie, dreckiger Ausländer!
The four outlanders gaped up in astonished silence at the enthroned giant and didn't hear Gundrun's hissed commands. Only when she struck the back of Kane's knee with the shaft of her spear and made his leg buckle did they realize she was ordering them to kneel. Even Grant was too stunned to do more than scowl at the Valkyries when he lowered himself to one knee.
Knien Sie in der Anwesenheit von Votenjas das Hohe. Knien Sie vor dem Vater vom Goldenen Bereich.
What's she saying?
Kneel in the presence of Votenjas, the High One. Kneel before the Father of the Golden Realm.
Votenjas?
Otherwise known as Votan, Woden, and Odin.
Kane squinted up at the figure on the throne.
That can't possibly be the same guy, can it?
She shook her head in rueful resignation.
I'm not sure of anything at this point.
Gundrun bowed her head.
Großer Vater, diese Ausländer bringen wichtige Nachrichten.
The inscrutable mask of the bearded man's face did not so much as twitch, but Kane received the distinct impression their arrival had caught him off guard. Votenjas stared down at them, then made an imperious gesture with his right hand, lifting it from the naked blade of the broadsword and spreading his fingers wide. The gesture had meaning to Gundrun, because she tapped Brigid lightly on the shoulder with her spear and jerked her head suggestively toward the man on the throne.
I guess it's time for me to convey the important news and explain ourselves.
I hope she makes the explanations quick. My knees are killing me.
Grant's hope was in vain.
Mächtiger Herrscher.
Brigid stepped close to the platform and spoke to Votenjas at great length, first haltingly and uneasily, then with greater confidence. Kane used the opportunity to look around the hall. The lack of any male warriors struck him as distinctly odd, but he figured the honor guard of Valkyries was more than sufficient to handle any threat. He counted 24 of them, all of them topping 6 feet in height. He eyed the gold-collared disc in the center of the floor and figured it was a capped fire pit, a vent of some kind extending down to a volcanic core. Tilting his head back, he studied the ceiling. Projecting from a socket in the roof directly over the fire pit was a thick-walled, heavy-gauge pipe. It reminded him of the barrel of a huge artillery piece. By visually measuring it, he realized it was just the right diameter to fit within the fire pit. Filboid interrupted his musing.
Are you thinking what I'm thinking?
Kane cut his eyes over to him. The man gazed upward, too.
Probably not. What are you thinking?
I'm thinking that big-ass pipe is a vent that can be lowered into the volcanic well. I'm thinking the heat is pumped up through it and through the top of the tower to the roof of the cavern. And on top of the roof, on the surface, is the ice sheet. I'm thinking that if enough heat is tapped and vented up to it, the whole shebang loosens up and melts, day by day, hour by hour.
I stand corrected. That's exactly what I was thinking. Mittlerweile sind Sie Gäste
vom Goldenen Bereich. Finally, the one-eyed man finished responding to Brigid. Brigid turned toward them, her expression very troubled and grave. Although Gundrun towered over her, she appeared somewhat sad, not threatened.
Erzählt, dass ihre Freunde steigen.
You can get up now.
The three men did so, although Grant had difficulty cursing under his breath. Without looking at him, Kane put a hand under his arm and heaved upward. The big man lurched unsteadily to his feet, grimacing in pain. Phil Boyd cast his eyes nervously from the foreboding figure of Votanyaz to Gundrun.
What's going on?
We're guests of the Golden Realm, at least until Grigori Zakat and his crew return.
Both Kane and Grant jerked their shoulders in reaction to the name.
So the son of a bitch is part of this place.
Bridget ran her gloved fingers through her tumbles of hair.
Yes and no. I'll explain later when we're alone.
A form of night fell swiftly over Ultima Thule. Grant, Bridget, Kane, and Philboyd sat unguarded in an inner room not far from the audience chamber. Grant half reclined on a couch, while the others sat in wooden chairs. Nobody objected that he took the couch. Despite his efforts to conceal it, his limp had become more pronounced over the past couple of hours. All of them sampled the ale and viands of Valkyrie served from golden platters and cups. Heavy blue velvet hangings decorated the walls, and bits of bric-a-brac, some of it exquisitely made, were scattered carelessly all about. Bridget rubbed one of the hangings between thumb and forefinger.
Blue, the royal color of Odin.
Does that one-eyed old guy really think he's king of the Norse gods? Or is he really the king of the Norse gods?
Neither. Votanyaz is more a title than a proper name, at least here. He inherited it from his predecessor 50 years ago.
Kane took a sip of the bitter ale and made a face.
Did he tell you about this place?
Bridget nodded.
He tried, but beyond a couple of 100 years ago, his knowledge is very vague and mixed up with myths and legends, some of it very improbable. But one thing I'm certain of, at this point in history, Ultima Thule is the oldest extant nation in the world.
How do you figure that?
Easy. They've existed unchanged and basically unchanging for at least 2,000 years, maybe even longer than that. They've survived everything since before the birth of Christ, including the Nuke Cost and Skydark.
Philboyd frowned, and Kane couldn't help but smile at the man's discomfort. As a scientist who expected everything in the universe to be classified and pigeonholed, he was knocked on his analytic ass when confronted by something outside his field of study.
Essentially, the Thuleans are the descendants of a Nordic colony that settled in and around Antarctica. Because of the heat provided by the volcanic cone here, they made it their primary city.
Which came first, the legends of Hyperborea, Asgard, and Thule, or these people?
Bridget shrugged.
A little of both, I would judge. They patterned their civilization on aspects of the Old Norse religion while adding to it, which then filtered out and became part of the entire myth cycle.
Why weren't they discovered before now?
Extensive exploration of the Antarctic continent didn't begin until the 20th century. Besides, they were discovered, or rather the Thuleans discovered the outside world. They weren't exactly hiding, although their existence was cast into doubt for many hundreds of years. Apparently, they preyed on shipping lanes at will, but the ships that went missing were assumed to have succumbed to the treacherous polar seas.
She smiled wryly.
And witnesses who reported seeing Viking raiders in dragon ships weren't believed.
Except by the Nazis.
Bridget nodded.
I'm afraid so. They made contact with the Thuleans before the end of World War II. And after it, some high-ranking Nazi officials fled here, hoping to base a new Reich from Thule.
Why didn't it work? World conquest sounds right up the Thuleans' alley.
From what I gathered from Votanyaz, the Nazis tried to rebuild Thule. They gave them technology, like the engines, the polarized plastics, and the ventilation ducts, but they tried to enslave them. So the Thuleans killed them.
Fulboyd wagged his head in denial.
This is too incredible. It's absurd. An intelligent culture living in isolation here for over 2,000 years, barely advancing beyond their ancestors?
You're ascribing our own culture's domination by technology to them. They picked and chose from technology bits and pieces that would help them, not take them over. That was the main point of contention between the Thuleans and Nazis. And the entire technology debate has been revived again, due to the arrival of Zakat.
Grant lifted his head from the couch.
How so?
Zakat was found out on the ice pack by a hunting party. Obviously, he came through the gateway, and rather than try to jump to a more hospitable environment, he decided to explore. Or walk until he died of exposure. A Valkyrie named Sif found him lying senseless not too far from the ventilation shaft. He was the first outsider she had ever seen. She brought him into Thule, more or less as a curiosity. Zakat was terribly injured, but he recovered in due time. Soon he learned their language and all of the inner mysteries of Thule.
Inner mysteries?
Votanyaz wasn't really clear on that, but I have a feeling he was referring to the technology left here by the Germans and other bits they had collected over the years. Most of it wasn't used or in disrepair. Zakat set about making it operational again. According to Votanyaz, the desire for power stirred in the man, and he coveted his throne. He scourged him, hoping to prove Zakat a coward, but he did not break. Instead, he gained the admiration of many of the warriors. He began filling their heads with dreams of glory, of sallying forth into the outside world as their Norse ancestors had done, to plunder and conquer. Zakat began plotting with other warriors to unseat Votanyaz. For months there was a series of plots and counterplots, and finally an attempted coup. Warriors and Valkyries alike died, but in the end, neither faction triumphed.
Why not?
The Valkyries had sworn allegiance to Votanyaz, to the title at any rate. If they betray him, they are doomed to an afterlife where they wander for eternity through a gray purgatory of ice and snow, never knowing redemption or rest. Besides, all the Thuleans fear Votanyaz, even those who chose Zakat. They believe him to be more god than ruler. The only way Zakat can usurp Votanyaz is to prove himself a god, and the only way to do that is bring about Ragnarok.
Kane rolled his eyes.
That sounds just like something out of that religion of his. What did he call it?
The Tenets of Causatry. Zakat studied the volcanic extrusion here and realized only a portion of the cone is above water level. The reservoir of hot magma that provides all the heat is also cooled by the water.
How come the water doesn't just boil away?
From what I can tell, this is what's known as a shield volcano. The column of lava doesn't rise out of the central conduit to the summit, but expands and forms domes on the sides. The cone increases in diameter, so an eruption isn't likely under normal circumstances. Zakat apparently intends to bring one about by tampering with it.
Why didn't Votanyaz just have Zakat killed instead of trying to discredit or humiliate him?
Tradition. It has been a tradition since the beginning of Thulean time that a warrior who covets kingship must fight for his crown, or have a champion do it for him. Zakat's champion is someone dear to Votanyaz, so he won't engage in single combat.
Let me guess. Sif, the Valkyrie who found Zakat, is Votanyaz's daughter, and she fell in love with him.
Worse. Sif is Votanyaz's wife, once his queen, once leader of the Valkyries. Now she has gone out voyaging with Zakat to bring back the means to jumpstart Ragnarok.
The corners of Kane's lips twitched in a humorless smile.
Is it just me, or does this sound really crazy?
It's not just you.
Grant lay his head back on the couch.
And you can't understand why I want to retire.
Kane awoke instantly, upper body snapping erect and dislodging Bridget's head from his shoulder. For a split second, he wasn't certain what had awakened him. Then he heard trumpets blaring a fanfare of triumph. Drums thundered and voices shouted and bellowed in a noisy, victorious clamor. Consulting his wristchron, Kane saw by the glowing digits they had been in the room for over 8 hours. His companion stirred, sitting up and blinking. Philboyd lifted his glasses and rubbed his eyes.
What's going on?
Kane didn't answer, a cold knot of tension forming in the pit of his stomach. Footsteps tramped heavily outside the door. He stood, Grant and Bridget following suit. After a moment, Philboyd did too. The door handle turned. Grant, Bridget, and Kane instantly recognized the tall, lean man who stood in the doorway, despite the mailed armor he wore, and the scar cutting down across his forehead. Grigori Zakat stared at them expressionlessly. Then he hugged himself as if he were cold. His body trembled and he bit his lips. Tears swam in his eyes. With an effort, Zakat managed to regain control of himself. His shoulders and legs continued to quiver, but it was due to unrepressed joy. He touched the phallic amulet hanging from his neck.
At last. Privately, I feared the events I set into motion wouldn't cycle through in the proper sequence to bring all of you to me. But my devotion and faith has been justified.
I think it has more to do with a ledge I didn't see in the dark than that little holy peony around your neck.
He paused to arch an eyebrow.
Or is that really your peony?
Sif! Er will wissen, wenn das wirklich meine Schwanz ist.
A giant blonde armored woman suddenly pushed past him into the room.
I just told Sif what you said. For some reason, she didn't find it as amusing as I did.
Yeah, I noticed she's not laughing.
Sif beckoned to Cain with a crooked forefinger.
She wants to know what happens when a Tulian warlord is disrespected.
When she brings me a Tulian warlord instead of a fused-out Russian, I'll be very interested.
Oh, I'm afraid I must insist you cooperate. Otherwise, Sif will demonstrate on one of your companions. The delectable Miss Baptiste, for example.
Cain took a deep breath and stepped forward. Bridget plucked at his arm.
Don't do it.
He didn't respond. He crossed the room and halted before Sif, gazing up at her with a neutral expression. Sif's knee flashed up, thudding solidly into Cain's midsection. He stumbled, off balance, but the shadow suit redistributed the worst of the impact. Still, the impact caused little pinwheels to ignite behind his eyes. Before they stopped whirling, Sif secured a stranglehold. Fingers like flexible iron bands locked around Cain's throat, the thumbs pressing against his larynx. Cain brought his forearms up and knocked the Valkyrie's hands away, or tried to. Her hold didn't break. She drove a knee into his groin, and as he doubled over, folding in the direction of the pain, Sif released him. He fell to his knees, and she kicked him in the side. Zakat spoke quietly to her, and she backed away, a cold, cruel smile playing over her face.
I think that will suffice.
Cain staggered to his feet, dizzy, panting, and nauseated. Grant steadied him as he drew in great gulps of air. Bridget strode aggressively up to Zakat, her eyes seething with jade flames of fury.
You're still a crazy bastard, Zakat!
The Russian struck her across the face with the back of his gloved right hand. Then, as if alarmed by his lack of self-control, he caught his hand and held it to his breast.
I apologize. The strain of these last few months has been almost intolerable. If you knew of the planning...
Planning for what? More piracy?
Planning for a venture to build a new world. A new empire of discipline and order. An empire none of you will ever see. In a sense, I regret killing you, Mr. Grant and Miss Baptiste. However, Cain has deeply wronged me and must be punished. Part of his punishment is death, of course, but the other part is watching all of you die before him.
Cain lurched toward him.
How did I wrong you, Zakat? You were my enemy. And when an enemy tries to kill you, you try to kill him in return. That's the first law of nature.
There are other laws, Cain. By the right of lex non scripto, the unwritten law, you believed you could kill me and suffer no consequences. But it was not so much you trying to take my life as the potential for power you wrested from me.
A hungry light suddenly flickered in Grigory Zakat's eyes, and he thrust his head forward eagerly.
The facets of the shining trapezohedron, Cain. Where are they? What did you do with them?
The same thing I tried to do to you. Chuck them off a cliff.
The Russian glared at him, first in suspicion, then in righteous wrath.
I believe you did that.
Would I lie to you?
Zakat shook his head, his hair flying around his face in a flurry of witchlocks.
You don't obey the law of power, and that's why you will suffer. All power has its price, whether in blood or dignity. Depending on the market value of the power sought, the price goes up.
A taunting smile creased Cain's lips.
I heard that before, right before you went over the cliff.
I know you thought I'd perished in Agartha, and you assumed that because I wished you to.
Zakat met the taunting smile with one of his own and fingered the scar on his forehead.
As it was, I was injured. Contusion, abrasions, lacerations, even a few broken bones. Painful, but I can control pain.
Zakat's eyes wandered as he fell into his narrative. Cain knew it was to their advantage to keep him talking.
So you climbed back up and left Agartha?
The Russian nodded.
Oh, you make it sound so simple, Cain. I wandered the length and breadth of those subterranean labyrinths for days, often in complete darkness. By the time I found my way, I was half dead from want. I began the long return trek up the mountain pass to the monastery on foot. I encountered a pack of bandits, and I sought to gain their aid. I identified myself as Chances Kanpo, the King of Fear. Do you know what they did next? They laughed at me. They called me a liar. They claimed they had already met the true King of Fear. They knew he was the true monarch, because he kept death up his sleeve. I knew it was you to whom they referred, Cain. You stole my title.
Cain recalled the incident with vivid clarity.
I killed the bandit chief, and the rest of them called me the King of Fear. I earned the title. I didn't steal it.
Zakat waved away Cain's objection.
Nevertheless, they kept me with them for a day and a night, torturing me, buggering me, beating me. On a whim, they decided to let me live and to free me. But first they held my right hand, my gun hand, my sword hand, in the fire until it was black and all the nerves were dead. Then they cast me out on the trail naked.
Zakat clamped his lips together. The light in his eyes was wild as he glanced down at his right hand.
You will never know my suffering on the mountain pass. No man could ever know the full horror of it. But I lived, and made it back to the monastery. I forced the soul monk who remained there to treat my wounds, but I feared to recuperate there since he seemed immune to my influence. So I took food and clothing, and used the Mattrans unit to escape. But only one of the destination codes showed an active receiving unit.
He cast his eyes upward toward the ice fields above.
And there my beloved Sif found me, and nursed me back to full health.
Yeah, we can see she's a real Clara Barton.
Zakat shifted his gaze toward him.
I don't know who you are, but I have a feeling you deserve everything that's about to happen to you.
Which is what?
Grigori Zakat grinned fiercely.
And I thought you might be afraid to ask.
The throne room was thronged with a glittering, armored host. The blare of golden trumpets rang across the hall as Zakat entered with Sif, Cain, Grant, Brigid, and Philboyd in tow. Vothanyaz gazed down from his throne, as motionless and expressionless as a statue. As they drew closer to the fire pit, Cain saw a wooden pallet resting on the floor. It was loaded with a number of metal drums marked with the letters HDX and several canisters and tanks. Grant turned to Cain.
Is that what I think it is?
It is. Enough incendiary and combustible chemicals to turn a dormant volcano into a nuclear bomb.
The Tulian warriors jeered and jostled the four outlanders as they walked a gauntlet of armored men toward the dais. Vothanyaz gestured toward Sif, and she marched toward the platform, climbing a short flight of steps to take a place beside the throne. Standing near the fire pit, Zakat threw a smirk toward the outsiders.
Here is the culmination of the long months of planning. I struck a deal with the pit boss of one of your quaint baronies, who was engaged in smuggling. He in turn introduced me to a contact who provided me with the proper weapons and materials I needed, not just to trigger Ragnarok, but to establish a new Thule.
By causing a new ice age? By being responsible for the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people and ravaging a world that is just now beginning to crawl back up out of barbarism?
Yes, that will give me what I need.
Do you need a world destroyed by floods and ice?
At this time, yes, I do. For many reasons, most of which you wouldn't understand, because you don't understand the principles by which I live.
Cain stared at him. He had no idea if Zakat's idea of increasing the volcano's heat output would actually send the Antarctic ice sheet sliding into the sea, but he knew even if he and his friends escaped, he couldn't leave the man in a position of power. Grigori Zakat was insane, unable to conceive of the horror of a world crusted in ice. He spoke low enough so that only Grant could hear.
I'm going to try something.
What?
Cain didn't answer. Instead, he put his head down and loped across the intervening yards between him and Zakat. The Russian saw him coming, and fear glinted in his eyes. A few armored Tulian warriors made grabs for him, but Cain was too fast. He left the floor in a flying dive and collided with Zakat. Both men went down in a tangle of arms and legs. Kane was atop him instantly, his magistrate-trained reflexes and fury driving him forward, knees slamming solidly into the man's flat stomach. He pistoned both fists into Zakat's face beneath him in a flurry of jabs and left and right hooks. The Russian's head rocked back and forth under the steady tattoo, blood springing from his nostrils, flying from split lips. Then strong arms grabbed Kane and hauled him backward.
I challenge you, Zakat. You and me. I issue the challenge.
A spear stabbed into his midsection but failed to penetrate. While the warrior gaped in astonishment, Kane snatched the shaft in his two hands and struck him in the belly with the butt of it. The men piled all over Kane, pinning his arms behind his back, punching him in the stomach. Kane continued to shout.
I challenge you, Zakat!
The Russian spit blood and stalked toward the restrained Kane. His lips peeled back over his red-filmed teeth.
You have no rights here.
We'll have the rights ceded to us.
With no one around her, she rushed to the foot of the throne platform. When a Valkyrie reached out to stop her, Votanyaz straightened in his throne, gesturing for her to stand aside. Zakat growled like an animal and caught Sif's eye, who shook her head. Rigid Baptiste had been granted an audience with the ruler, and no one could now interfere. Brigid spoke in the Tulian dialect.
The man who has come among you, Grigori Zakat, is a liar. He represents a greater threat to your people's freedom than did the Nazis of long ago. He wishes to be king, to be a monarch, the master of the Ragnarok. He will use you to engineer.
Sif stepped to the edge of the dais and gestured contemptuously toward Brigid, then the others.
Grigori Zakat has mighty plans for a mighty people. If the outer world is overrun by barbarians, he will aid us in bringing the lesser breeds to such a pass that their only hope for survival lies in surrender to Tulian domination.
Brigid started to speak again, but Votanyaz cut her off with a raised hand. His attitude was one of weariness, of having heard it all before.
Enough. Debate is not our way. Tule has existed for countless centuries, bound by our customs and traditions. One of those traditions is that anyone who wishes to wear the helmet of kingship must fight for it, or have his champion do so. Zakat's champion is Zif, and I cannot fight her. I have no champion to fight in my stead.
I think you do.
She glanced questioningly toward Kane, still caught fast in the grip of the Tulians. He nodded curtly. Gundrun snapped the manacle around Kane's left wrist and gave the slender chain an experimental tug.
Werde nicht getäuscht. Diese Kette ist ebenso stark als das ein, das Fenris gebunden hat.
Don't be fooled. This chain is as strong as the one that bound Fenris.
Whatever the hell that means.
Gundrun fed the other end of the chain through an eyelet in the pipe. A Valkyrie on the far side connected the end link to an identical manacle and snapped it around Sif's wrist. She stared at Kane expressionlessly across the fire pit. The venting pipe had been lowered from the ceiling and it was positioned 4 feet above the cover disc. Zakat spoke earnestly to Sif, who listened intently, a look of serene detachment on her face. Her long flaxen hair was tied in a single thick braid that hung down her back. She was stripped of her armor, her Valkyrie's finery, and wore a dark, close-fitting leather tunic, cinched at the waist by a length of knotted rawhide. Kane was dressed similarly. The Tulians had insisted on it. He wasn't sure if the mode of garb was traditional for single combat, or because the warriors became suspicious when they couldn't gut him during the melee.
Even if you win, it may not change anything. Zakat has a lot of support here.
Kane shrugged.
At the very least, we'll delay Zakat dumping all those chemicals down the gullet of the volcano.
I've been thinking about that. I doubt he'll get the result he's hoping for. More than likely, he'll set off underground explosions that will blow vents in the sides of the cone below the water level. They get one hell of a steam bath, and probably parboil all of Ultima Thule in the process.
That's nice to know. But we'll still be here and get boiled right along with them.
Philboyd swallowed.
I guess you're right.
Brigid glanced into Kane's face. Her eyes were worried, her expression pinched.
I wish I could be sure what the outcome of this contest will be. If you kill Sif, Votanyaz is liable to kill you right along with Zakat.
Kane smiled thinly.
That possibility occurred to me. but I think he's a man of honor.
Grant pursed his lips as if he tasted something exceptionally sour.
Wouldn't that be a nice change?
Votanyaz lifted his voice above the murmuring throng.
Kompfen!
A male warrior and a Valkyrie removed the two sections of the fire pit cover. Kane felt the intense heat rising out of the well in an almost solid column, like a physical assault. A man handed Sif a short-handled axe. A Valkyrie pressed a twin to it into Kane's hand. He hefted it, checking its balance. Then Sif gave the chain a terrific yank, and Kane catapulted off the floor. He managed to keep his footing, but he staggered on the lip of the pit. He teetered, arms windmilling, squinting away from the orange and red glow from below. It was like looking down the throat of hell. Sif sprang in, chopping at Kane's head, but it was a feint. The Valkyrie meant to make a swift and shifty fight of it. Kane returned the blow with a cut at Sif's legs. The woman bounded high, clearing the blade easily, and in midair hacked down at Kane's head, meaning to separate it from his shoulders. He hurled himself to one side, and the axe blade chopped into the collar of tiles, slicing one in two. Kane didn't hesitate. He shot out his left leg in a sweeping kick that caught the backs of Sif's ankles and dumped her over on her back with a heavy thud. They struggled to their knees on the rim of the fire pit. The wavering heat waves drew sweat out of both of them. Kane almost felt as if his skin were shriveling under its blast. Sif swung her axe again in a whistling curve, and Kane's flashed up to meet it. Steel rang together with a painful clash, and both blades shattered, flying fragments nicking their flesh and drawing blood. The Valkyrie gaped at the wooden haft in her hand, then dropped it and reached for Kane's throat. But her arm was numbed by the force of the blow, and Kane easily slapped it aside. A fierce jab opened a gash above Sif's eyebrow. Scarlet oozed into her eye, blinding her. Sif tried to exchange punches with Kane, but her flailing fists missed their weaving target or rebounded from his forearms. She hurled herself forward, fingers bent into claws. Kane caught her wrists, noting fearfully it was like grabbing two bars of tempered steel. They tumbled over the floor, locked in each other's arms. Sif's fingers slipped on Kane's sweat-slick arms, and her grasp was so powerful, his skin peeled away in strips as if he were scalded. Yeah. Sif drove a fist against his chin, jarring his teeth together. He clutched the braid of her hair and jerked.
Oh!
She shrieked and struck at him again. Unwilling to release his hold on her hair, Kane slid to one side, feeling Sif's fist skim along the side of his face, tearing at his ear. Kane raised his knee, driving into Sif's belly. Sif swung again, howling with rage. The mallet-like blow caught Kane on top of the shoulder, briefly numbing his arm. Sif looped the slack of the chain and dropped it over Kane's head, tightening it around his neck. She struggled to rise behind him. Kane knew she intended to garrote him to death, so he heaved back and forth, twisting within the noose of the chain and scraping his flesh raw. He struggled to get to his feet, and for an instant he was nose-to-nose with the Valkyrie. Only cold, naked fury showed in Sif's eyes. Kane thrust the crown of his head at the woman's face, but she turned her head and caught the blow on the side of her jaw. Still, Sif bent over backward, over the lip of the pit. Kane was forced to throw himself in the opposite direction to pull her away, so she wouldn't drag him down as well. She fell inside Kane's reach. He threw his left arm out, locking it around and behind Sif's right arm, trapping it. Sif struggled to get free of the hammerlock, and Kane slid his right arm around her neck. He forced her down on the tiled collar, encircling the rim of the fire pit. The tiles had already absorbed the terrific volcanic heat, and when her cheek touched one, he heard a faint sizzle as of meat tossed on a griddle, and she howled in pained agony. Kane lifted her clear of the tiles. Sif gagged, clutching at Kane's arm. She inserted her fingers into the crook of his elbow, and to his astonishment, she actually began prying it away. Kane increased the pressure, bearing down.
Ergebe nicht, Sif! Strike den Ausländer mit Wucht!
Zakat shrieked something, and Kane glanced up to see him nearly dancing in mad frustration, crimson-flecked spittle flying from his lips. Brigid's sharp voice cut through the murmur of the onlookers like a knife.
Zakat is telling her not to yield! He wants you to kill her!
Kane could only guess at the reason, but he figured the death of Sif at the hands of an outlander might sway both the Valkyries and Votanyaz to his side.
Nee! Ergebe nee! Capitulera nee!
Kane couldn't understand Sif's words, but he gleaned their meaning. She told him she would never yield, never surrender. Despite her tone of defiance, Sif's respiration was strained and panicked. Kane reached a swift conclusion with only the vaguest concept of how his decision might turn out. He released Sif, pushing away from her and standing. As he backed out of range of her arms and legs, he called to Brigid over his shoulder.
Baptiste, what are the Tulian words for "I give you back your life"?
Sif slowly climbed to her feet, regarding Kane with a glare of pure venom. She touched the reddened welt on her cheek where the tile had burned it.
Baptiste!
Kane didn't dare take his eyes off the Valkyrie as she advanced on him, gathering the slack of the chain in a loop in one hand and slapping it against the other. Suddenly, Brigid shouted out a string of confusing consonants.
Ich kehre ihr Leben zu ihnen zurück!
Ich kehre ihr Leben zu ihnen zurück.
Kane still tried to back away from Sif.
Ich kehre ihr Leben zu ihnen zurück.
Votanyaz suddenly rose from his chair, assumed his full formidable height, and lifted his great broadsword over his head.
Halt! Dieser Wettkampf ist beendet. Die Schlacht ist vollendet.
Sif instantly jolted to a halt. Her blonde head swiveled toward her husband, her eyes wide with shock. Brigid came quickly to Kane's side.
It worked, Kane. You worked it out when I couldn't. Votanyaz was hoping you'd do what you did.
Grant and Philboyd bracketed them.
Just what did you do? What's going on?
Since Kane spared Sif's life when he could have taken it, she can no longer champion the cause of Zakat.
Kane gulped in oxygen and rubbed his neck, glad to be away from the scorching air around the fire pit. Gratefully, he unlocked the manacle around his wrist.
That's what I figured he was up to when he agreed to a trial by combat, even though I wasn't a Tulian. Zakat outsmarted himself by having Sif as his champion, whom Votanyaz wouldn't fight.
Grigori Zakat stared in open-mouthed terror as Votanyaz majestically descended from the platform, the broadsword in his hand gleaming like quicksilver. The milling throng parted for him. The man was at least 7 feet tall, and he looked almost as broad. He was a living juggernaut, a figure not just of legend, but vengeance, justice, and death. Zakat rushed to Sif, clutching frantically at her arms.
Hilfe mir! Rette mir! Ich brauche deine Hilfe bitte!
She shook him off, not looking at him, as if his touch tainted her. Zakat turned his gaze toward Kane, his lips working, mouthing words no one could hear. He glanced into the implacable faces of Valkyrie and warrior alike, but none of them acknowledged his presence. Even if any one of them were inclined to interfere, they were forbidden by ancient ritual, custom, and law. Zakat spun toward Votanyaz, who strode toward him with the confident swagger of a tiger approaching its prey, his blue cloak belling out behind him. If he so coveted the rulership of Ultima Thule, Zakat knew he would have to duel Votanyaz for the crown, and even Sif knew he couldn't possibly emerge victorious. Nostrils flaring, Zakat stared wide and wild-eyed toward Kane. His face contorted. He began to tremble violently, his eyelids flickering, spittle collecting at the corners of his mouth. Kane met his gaze.
Why don't you tell him about the time you were the King of Fear, Grigori? That might make him change his mind about chopping you into about 100 pieces and feeding you your peony.
Zakat's left hand clutched at his amulet. His body quaked, 1,000 changing sparks of light dancing in his eyes. Then he threw his head back and screamed, a howl of terror, of fury torn from the roots of his soul. He bounded toward Kane, hands raised, fingers curved like talons. Grant made a motion to intercept him, but Kane elbowed him back. He whiplashed the chain across the floor, separating him from the oncoming Russian. The manacle struck Zakat's temple with a loud crack of bone, spinning him and sending him staggering to the edge of the fire pit. His feet scrabbled for purchase on the gilded tiles, then he slipped over the rim. The fingers of his left hand hooked onto the edge, and he hung there, over the terrible heat. Kane sauntered over to the pit and gazed down at Zakat. His face was twisted in exertion.
We've been in this situation before, Kane.
Kane nodded.
I remember.
He bent over, extending a hand.
This time, I won't let you fall.
Zakat's eyes widened in surprise. Then the looming figure of Votanyaz cast a shadow over his face as he stood shoulder to shoulder with Kane.
I understand why. You prefer to see me humiliated before you see me dead.
Actually, I don't care what order they're in.
Kane reached down.
Make up your mind.
Grigori Zakat's lips writhed over his teeth in either a grin or a grimace when he released his grip. Kane caught only a glimpse of him as he plummeted down the volcano's conduit and into the inferno of its belly. He didn't see or hear his body plunge into the magma, but the unmistakable stench of seared human flesh and scorched hair wafted up in a noxious cloud. Votanyaz nodded brusquely, as if deeply satisfied with the way everything turned out, as though it had all gone according to an intricate plan. He regarded Cain solemnly for a long, silent moment. Then his lips quirked in a smile beneath his beard. With a flourish of his cloak, Votanyaz pivoted on his heel and marched over to Zif. She dropped to her knees before him, head bowed, eyes downcast. Grant inclined his head toward Cain.
Think you'll kill her?
Not after all of this.
Phil Boyd stepped up close.
Will he take her back?
Cain pondered the query for a moment, but Bridget interrupted his thoughts.
There's an old Latin saying, Victoria et pro victoria vita. Victory and for victory, life. Votanyaz won a great victory for himself and for us. No one could wish for anything better. He'll take her back.
Then the assembled Tullians shook spears and swords and axes over their heads and began singing about the glorious days to come. Outlander's Equinox Zero is a Graphic Audio production. Outlanders and all characters are trademarks owned by Harlequin Enterprises Limited, used by others under license. Copyright 2003, Worldwide Library, all rights reserved. Production copyright 2005, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Performed by Terence Hazelford, Nanette Savard, Thomas Penny, Richard Rowan, Kate Torrey, and Colleen Delaney. Additional red shirts by The Dead Giveaways. Directed by Terence Hazelford. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing by Nathaniel Perry. Graphic audio sound design by Chris Rowan and Brian Rogers. The Outlanders theme was composed by Norman Vanderslice. Additional original music by Chris Rowan. If you enjoyed Outlanders, be sure to look for James Axler's Deathlands, available at road stops everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloadable extras, forums, and podcasts. Keep listening for a preview of another Graphic Audio title.
The following preview is of a Graphic Audio production rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
Available now from Graphic Audio.
From Deathland 64, Bloodfire.
Keep walking. We rest at night.
Stepping over the buried sign, JB turned away and started walking when there was a crackling sound and his leg went into the ground all the way to the knee. Panic hit the man, and as he tried to yank the limb free, cracks spread outward from the small hole, with more pieces of the white ground falling away to enlarge the opening with frightening speed. Suddenly coming loose, JB attempted to dive away from the expanding gap, but not fast enough, and he fell into the blackness below.
John!
Throwing himself forward, Ryan hit the cracking ground and thrust out a hand to try to grab his friend, even though he knew it was totally hopeless.
JB!
Incredibly, Ryan touched cloth, and he grabbed the back of the wiry man's jacket in an iron grip. Then the armorer stood, the top of his hat only inches below the salty plain.
Good Lord!
Doc took a half step forward. In the afternoon light angling into the crevice, the companions could see that JB was standing on the roof of a pre-dark building.
Only fell 5 feet. Damn near thought I was taking a long ride.
Climb onto the billboard. I can hoist you up from there.
But before the armorer could move, a faint vibration shook the entire desert, and 100 tiny puffs of dust rose from different locations across the flatland. Now a horrible stench welled from below, increasing as the cracks began to widen. Visibly, the salt fall was shifting position, huge sections rising and falling slightly.
Oh, Christ. The pressure dropped. When we broke the crust, it let out ancient gases supporting the dome. Like popping a balloon, the whole salt land is starting to collapse.
Ryan started to speak when 100 feet away, a huge section of the sparkling white ground shook and plummeted out of sight.
Get on the roof!
Yeah.
He jumped into the hole. He landed hard, sprawling near the ventilation fan. A foot to the left and he would have been gutted by the salt-encrusted blades. The others were only a heartbeat behind, the white landscape crumbling under their boots. Now the crackling noise seemed to fill the world, and the entire area began to quake, thin cracks shooting in every direction. Then the cracks yawned wide, and the white dome broke apart completely. Coming loose, myriad pieces dropped into the reeking hurricane from below, and the crackling grew into a strident roar that steadily increased in volume and power until the companions were forced to cover their ears. Rancid winds buffeted them from every direction, and the building violently shook, the stone and steel groaning as if in pain. It was as if the world were dying. The tempest was worse than any earthquake they had encountered, louder and more violent than the eruption of a South Seas volcano. Almost as if Skydark had returned to finish the job of destroying the scourge of humanity. Now, billowing clouds of pulverized salt rose over the edge of the building, covering them in a sparkling blizzard. Helpless in the maelstrom, the companions clustered together, fighting to stay alive through the savage pounding and rampaging chaos of the collapsing salt dome. The noise and destruction seemed to last forever. Then slowly, an immense white plume rose into the sky and began to form a horrifying shape of a dreaded mushroom cloud. Eventually, the rumbling winds passed, and the companions slowly eased their hands away from their faces to fill their aching lungs with the clean, fresh air blowing in from the desert. Dusted white from the billowing salt, Ryan blinked hard to clear his vision and could finally see again. The building under their boots still shook slightly, but the salt dome was gone, exposing something from another world. It was a pre-dark city. The companions were standing on top of a skyscraper that rose above a perfectly preserved town that appeared to stretch for dozens of blocks in every direction, maybe more. The city filled a circular depression in the ground, edged by a sheer rock wall that rose to the desert floor above them. For a moment, Ryan had a rush of vertigo as he adapted to the fact that he had fallen down to land high in the sky. White salt clouds moved like fog along the streets, and a raging fire burned out of control in an intersection where a gasoline tanker had been flattened by the plummeting tons of the falling dome. Doc turned around in a circle in unabashed wonder.
By the three Kennedys, it is as if we have traveled backward in time.
A pre-dark city. Not a ruin, but the whole damn thing.
If you can't find that hot graphic audio title you're looking for, just head to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD or MP3 disc format. Or, the fastest and cheapest way, download that puppy and play it on any of the many devices that'll play Windows Media. And if you're on the road or just a total computer feeb, snatch up the phone and call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net.